Okay, let us begin with some chanting. We have the chanting sheets have been passed around, I believe. Let us begin.
Yes.
Namo tassa bhagavato Namo tassa So for this week, we are in the fourth out of the four talks on Introduction to Buddhist Meditation, which has followed the pattern of the four satipatthanas, the four establishments of mindfulness, or the four kinds of mindfulness meditation. First week, we focused on the body as being the foundation for practice, both in terms of one's ethical conduct. So in Buddhism, ethics and keeping living a good life and having a good character is essential as a foundation for meditation practice. And then begin to practice. We went through the details of how to establish your meditation practice, your posture, the place you're going to practice, the time you're going to practice, and also having a clear sense of purpose about how you're going to approach the meditation. And I emphasized about how all Buddhist meditation must be grounded in mindfulness of the body. Okay, if your meditation is too all over the place, too vague, too conceptual, to anything like that, it's not going to be successful. It has to be grounded in a concrete way in mindfulness of the body. And then we took up mindfulness of breathing as being the most commonly used and very often the most useful form of being mindfulness, mindful of the body. And I talked about how the initial experience of the breath as a physical flow of air that stills through the body brings peace to your body and to your mind. So that rather than trying to concentrate on the breath, we take the attitude of letting the breath come to us and letting the breath calm us down. When the breath has calmed us down in this way, we experience tranquility, we experience joy, and we experience happiness. So this brings us to the second week, which was talking about feelings and the role of feelings in meditation. All of us who have meditated at least once know that in meditation you feel a lot of things, and you know that whenever they publish advertising for meditation with someone sitting there looking very peaceful and serene, that's a lie. Okay, that is a lie. They're sitting there struggling, oh my god, I can't, oh, what's happening on? And all of these feelings are coming through, but you just stay there. It's interesting, isn't it? It's an interesting thing that the idea that rather than being a slave to your feelings, that you just watch them. You feel some pain and you don't have to actually do anything about it. You can just feel pain, it's all right. Not great, but it's all right. And then you just watch it and you're like, oh, okay. And then it kind of goes away after a while, or at least it's not so annoying. And then you also feel pleasure. So while it's true that in meditation you're going to feel every kind of feeling that has a name, and probably quite a few that don't have names, but the feeling that actually brings us deeper into meditation is the feeling of pleasure and happiness. Yeah. So that will then lead the mind to stillness and to clarity and to brightness, which brings us onto the third stage, which is the contemplation of mind, which we talked about last week. And I talked about how the mind, when it's purified and free of those things that obstruct awareness, will become brilliant and will become quite amazing and will become transformed. So these are the first three stages of Satsaripatthana. So today I'm going to be talking about the fourth stage, Dhammanupassana, contemplation of dhammas, which in this case is best translated as principles, i.e. the principles of cause and effect. We've already been doing this all the way through, because at the end of each meditation, I've been asking you to reflect back over the meditation to understand the process of meditation. And that is Dhammanupassana. That's contemplation of principles or observation of principles. Understanding why things happen. This goes on. Why is my mind peaceful? Why is my mind agitated? What is it that causes it? When you understand cause and effect, then you will be able to meditate, not just when you feel good, not just when the stars align and you have a miraculous meditation, but you'll be able to have a good meditation every time, because you understand how your mind works. All right? So this is the practice of Dhammanupassana. And so this is this kind of practice is taught under many names in Buddhism. Sometimes Dhamma Vichaya, investigation of Dhammas. Sometimes Dhamma Vipassana, the discernment of Dhammas or insight meditation, and many other names besides. So this is about looking at what is happening in your mind and understanding cause and effect, right? Now, a few details to notice, and then we will begin. We'll do some guided meditation. First detail to notice is that this is contemplating cause and effect, right? But it's not contemplating cause and effect generally, okay? It's contemplating cause and effect in your meditation, in the context of your meditation, understanding that. Why is that important? Because that's telling you how your mind works. And once you understand that, you will then understand your mind more broadly, more generally. But you're seeing it in a very specific and very particular circumstance. This is what's really interesting about it. Because you've spent your that whole time clarifying your mind, stilling your mind, when you then look back, everything is so much clearer. You can look at it and you can say, oh, wow, it's amazing. You can see, like, how, for example, how do you get trapped in anger and these angry thoughts going round and round your head? And you can look at it and you can see that. God, why do I do that to myself? And it's like so obvious that you have those thoughts going around and you can just see them. And then when you let go of them, you can see the peace that comes from letting go. Those are the moments that you look for, right? When you're meditating, right, you'll be going along, meditate, mind's here, mind's there, doing this, whatever. And then suddenly you might look around and think, I'm actually quite peaceful now. How did that happen? It's almost like the peace sneaks up on you when you're not looking for it. It's like you're looking over here and then suddenly the peacefulness happens over here and you turn around and you're like, yeah, I'm quite peaceful now. So again, through reflection and reviewing, in Pali we say pachavekana, literally is to review, to look back down, or patisankha is reflection. And these processes are ways that we deepen wisdom through actively investigating the meditation. And just to emphasize that there has to be an active element to this. Wisdom doesn't just happen. Okay, so there are stages in the development of wisdom. Very briefly in Buddhism, we would say that wisdom develops through three or four stages, depending on how you want to analyze it. But the first stage is through what we're doing here. This is suttamayapanya. This is like listening through learning, through thinking and reflecting and so on. So this is one level of wisdom. That's a preliminary level of wisdom, which gives us the map or the guide, which is going to help us along our journey. But it isn't the journey. Second kind is of the inquiry and investigation. So this is where we are looking into our own mind and discerning what's happening in our mind. So that's what we're talking about here. And that has to require an active process. The third level of wisdom is intuitive wisdom. Intuitive wisdom comes when all of those earlier factors are done, when you've learned things, when you've inquired, and when you've made your mind peaceful and so on and so forth, and all the factors come together, then you have intuitive wisdom arises. Actually, we have intuitive wisdom all the time. You don't have to wait for that point. But the problem is that the intuitive wisdom that we have is also confused. So it's not always reliable. Like we have an intuition, and it's true. And then we're like, oh, yeah, now I have that intuitive wisdom. But then as soon as that happens, then your conceit gets involved. And actually, it's because it's not purified. It's not reliable. I'll tell you one story about that. So some years ago, we were doing a talk like this over in North Sydney. We had a camera to record it. And the guy who was doing the camera pushed the handle too hard and broke it. And we needed a new stand for the camera, fine. The next day we looked up a couple of places online, we couldn't see what it was, whatever. And that day we were in Newtown. We went for dana at this restaurant, blah, 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 lunch at the restaurant. We're walking back and took a back street through Newtown. So you know Newtown has these little alleyways and so on. We took this random back street none of us had ever been on before. Somebody sitting on his front porch with like a garage sale, but like half a dozen things for sale. And you guessed it. One of them was this very video camera stand, which is exactly the one that we needed. And he showed us how to adjust it so that we weren't going to break it again in the future. So we were like, wow, that's really amazing, you know. And the conclusion that I drew from that was that you never had to organize anything. You just walked along and there it was, okay? So I decided and your intuitive wisdom would bring you to that place. I admit, it was a small sample size. Still, though. Worth trying out. So then we had to go later on that same day. We had to go to Telstra for some reason, in Macquarie at the big Westfield, a big shopping centre there. Anyway, so we just had to get a couple of small bits, and like a connector or a lead or something like that. And so we're like, oh, it's a big, huge shopping centre. Where's the Telstra shop? So we just pulled up and said, don't worry about it. So we just park the car wherever there's a parking spot. We'll get out and we'll just walk straight to the Telstra shop. If the more you worry about, the longer it's going to take. So that's what we did. We parked the car, we got out, we walked, and literally walked straight to the Telstra shop. I said, see? So anyway, we got what we needed. We came back and we opened it in the van when we got back, and they'd actually put the wrong bit in the box. So we had the wrong bit. What do you mean? We had the wrong bit. So I'm like, don't worry about it. I'll just pop back to the Telstra shop, you know. Same thing, because we'd now moved. We were leaving. Like, so we got in the car, we were leaving. So I was now coming from a different place. Don't worry, I'll just pop up to the Telstra shop. I had no idea where it was because my intuitive wisdom had left. So this time I get out and I'm wandering around the whole shopping centre. Yes. That's the I. I'm like, I'm the one who has the intuitive wisdom. Yeah, I can find my way. So there you go. That's a little story. That's why. Yes, intuitive wisdom sounds great, and it is great, and it is very important, but you can't always trust it because your sense of self gets involved. So that's why, as it emerges from that whole path of practice, then you can see that actually your sense of self will still get involved. As long as you're not enlightened, your sense of self will get involved. Yeah? But you will see it. Yeah. If you're meditating clearly and your mindfulness is clear, you'll be like, oh, yeah, you can feel that conceit coming up. Oh, yeah, that attachment. Oh, that identification. And then you can let go of it. So it's usually not a problem. Usually. Okay, so this is the path of like reflection on the meditation leading to wisdom, specifically reflecting on those things that are obstructing the meditation and those things that are supporting the meditation, right? And you want to see what is actually helpful and what is hindering. So I'm going to talk more about that for the talk after, but let's do some guided meditation. So for this meditation, we're just going to do a brief calming meditation with mindfulness of breathing, and then we'll do an extended period of reflection. So it's going to be similar to what we've done before, but just changing the balance of it. So sitting quietly and give yourself a few minutes for your mind and your body to settle down. Just notice the energy in your body, the mood. Notice how you're feeling. Leaving your mind settled in your heart. Become aware gently of that soft feeling of the breath as it comes in, the breath as it goes out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. When your mind starts to think about this and that, just be aware of it. Okay. That's what my mind wants to think about right now. Take note of it, be aware, and then come back, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. So now I want you to take your mind, reflect back. I want you to look at how your mind has been changing and how the different parts of your mind are interacting. So you can begin by identifying what is the dominant or main emotion that you're feeling now. Maybe anger, maybe joy, maybe boredom. It's okay if you can't even put a name to it. It's okay. But just to try to feel what it feels like. And then see if you can see how that feeling then prompts other things. For example, the feeling will prompt thoughts. You have a feeling of desire and prompts thoughts of desire. Perhaps it calls up memories, images. Perhaps it makes you look forward to something in the future. Or long to change something in the present. Recall how that has affected your behavior, your values, your speech. And what is it like now when you are not acting out on it? Just watching carefully with empathy and clarity. It's curious that that emotion, that drive, shapes our life in such profound ways, yet when we look for it, it's empty. There's hardly anything there. Just a ghost of a shadow. Just a fleeting glimpse. You feel like you felt something, but you can't quite put your finger on it. But you notice that there is a cycle. A mood, an intention, a thought, a memory. And then that reinforces the mood and that reinforces more thoughts. And round it goes. And you realize that you can't really change your mood, but you can change your thoughts. You can recognize, that's a thought driven by anger. And you can let go of that thought. You can stop thinking that thought because it is you who is thinking it. It's coming from that anger. And when you have mindfulness present, the thought stops. And in its place is awareness. And once you've done that a few times, you begin to realize how powerless the anger is. How ineffectual it is. When it can't keep driving this cycle of thought and perception and memory and volition. It just sits there. You can have empathy for it. Okay, that's how I feel. But as it's not being fueled, not being sustained, it will tend to just disappear, sometimes quite quickly. When you see that place where everything fades away, what's left is peacefulness, awareness, understanding. Okay, so now we're coming to the end of the meditation. And to finish off, let us dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be safe, may all beings be happy, may all beings be free from suffering and oppression. Okay, good. Thanks for that. Let's have a bit of a break. And I just remembered I wanted to make a special dedication tonight for the people of Iran, who have suffered so much in recent months under their oppressive government, and looks like they're going to be suffering even more in the coming days. So, okay. Have a break, have a cup of tea, come back for some Dhamma talks. Okay, so this final talk in the series, I'm going to talk a little bit more about the contemplation of Dhammas, and I'm going to discuss a few of the, we looked at it from a practical perspective just now, and about how we can investigate. And I'm going to discuss a little bit of the background and the theory behind this and the terminology and so on, because it is an area where there are a lot of words that have been spoken about it. Too many. And everyone's written books about mindfulness. There's so many books about mindfulness. It's ridiculous. I wrote a really big, thick book about mindfulness with lots of footnotes and stuff. It's so embarrassing. Why? There's too many books about mindfulness. There's like eightfold paths. And if you look at like modern books, it's like right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right mindfulness. Everyone's talking about mindfulness. Anyway, whatever. So I am part of the problem. I freely admit I'm part of the problem. So the ideal talk about mindfulness would in fact like suck some of the words out of the atmosphere and just leave silence behind, but I guess I have to say something. Okay, so this last one on contemplation of Dhammas has been, I think, widely misinterpreted. Look, I did this long study years ago in my foolish youth, where I looked at all of the different versions of the Satipatthana Sutta, and I looked at, there's like six versions in Chinese or something ridiculous like that, and then Sanskrit and all of these things. And I did this whole comparative analysis. I published it as a book, A History of Mindfulness. If you're suffering from insomnia, I do recommend it. But the upshot of it is, one of the things that I found out, like it was fascinating as the research process, you know, and it's more of a resource book than anything else. It's not a casual book on mindfulness. But I wanted to look at how the way that we talked about mindfulness has evolved and changed over the years, right? And what we mean by mindfulness and how we talk about it is conditioned by time and place. And think about it. If we had not heard the word meditation, we wouldn't be meditating, right? We think that meditation is like beyond words or beyond concepts, but actually it's the concepts and the understanding that we bring is what shapes what we're actually doing in meditation. And there's a whole history to that, 2,500 years of history, in fact. And part of that history is actually being published at the moment. If you have a look at our sort of central discourse forum, there's a series of articles that's been written about the history of the modern Vipassana movement, Vipassana Goenka, Burmese meditation system. and that's been posted on our sort of central forum as they're getting completed. And it's actually really interesting to see who are the people were behind that and what was the process and so on. So even though we have the idea that these are kind of timeless meditation techniques, they've always been practiced like that and so on and so forth, the reality is that they're very much a product of their time and they've been shaped by particular people and particular approaches. So I wanted to look back and say, well, what was the Buddha talking about when he talked about mindfulness? One of the things that we find in when we do that is that under this fourth, and we find that generally speaking, these first three, body, feelings, and mind, are pretty much the same in every version we look at. But this fourth one actually varies quite a lot. One of the reasons for that is because it's contemplation of dhammas. And dhammas can mean, well, pretty much anything. Phenomena, principles, laws, rules, realities, nature, truth. It is a very polysemic word. So what does it actually mean in this particular context? And it's often translated as contemplation of mind objects, contemplation of phenomena, and so on and so forth. But what is it really about? One of the things, so when you do this comparative study, you see all of these things that are different, but you find that there are three things that are the same. And there are three things in this particular contemplation that are always there in basically in every version. And those three things are the five hindrances, the seven awakening factors, and the four noble truths. And these are always there. And what is also very similar in all of these is that they are all treated in terms of cause and effect. That is to say, we don't just talk about the fact that these things are present. We ask, why are they present? How do they originate? What is it that sustains them? How do they come to an end? How do you stop them from re-arising? Or if they're positive qualities, how do you develop them to fulfillment? So I'm going to talk a little bit about these things, which I believe constitute the original specification of contemplation of dhammas. Right? So I think in this case, what I've been talking about now so far is what we call text critical study. Text critical study is often uncertain. And there are many times when we can't really confidently say, something. But this particular finding, I believe, is quite solid. And I think I'm quite confident that this was, in fact, the original specification of the observation of dhammas. And that's why I taught it the way that I did in the meditation beforehand. So let's briefly recap what these things are. Number one, five hindrances, okay? Ishika. Put you on the spot. How many are there? Excellent. Excellent. Thank you so much. And what are they? Craving? Aversion? Sloth and torpor? And what's the last one? Is it though? I'm sorry. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, forgive me. All right, so these are the five hindrances. And these five hindrances they're pretty much usually familiar to most meditators, right? And when we sit down to meditate, so these things are things that the Buddha said were... They're like the most like obvious and most powerful obstructions to meditation. Of course, there are more subtle things as well, but within these, we find like most of the things that are actually an obstacle to the mind becoming peaceful in meditation. And of course, they manifest in all kinds of different ways. I won't treat them in detail right now, but just very briefly. So under the heading of desire or sensual desire, any kind of like longing or wanting for something, wanting for food, wanting for comfort, wanting for sex, wanting for enjoying nice sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, all of those kinds of things come within sensual desire. Right? So most of us have experienced those things when in meditation, next aversion, right? Disliking things, getting angry. Sometimes when you're meditating, even these things can get inflamed because your mind can spiral off if your mindfulness isn't strong, and you can sit there and actually get very jealous or very annoyed, or you can sit there. Revenge is a good one. You can, I did that on my first retreat. I spent like 2 days plotting revenge against somebody who'd done me wrong before I just planned a retreat. That wasn't very skillful. Don't worry, I didn't do it. I just plotted it. Okay, and so all of those things. But it can of course also be very mild, very minor things as well. Sloth and torpor, right? So most of us, if we meditated at all, we probably felt tired, felt weary, fallen asleep. Look, if you fall asleep occasionally from meditation because you're tired, don't worry about it. It's natural, right? But make sure you don't get into a habit of drifting off and falling asleep when you meditate. Be very clear in your mind that meditation is about the mind being bright and awake. If you're sitting there and drifting off into a nice little dozy sleep every time you meditate, can be nice, but you're not going to proceed in your meditation. Okay, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse. Restlessness runs off to the future, remorse drags up the past. Okay, so these are things that are pulling us out of the present and disturbing the mind. Yeah. So, and then finally, doubt. Now, doubt is a subtle one because doubt by itself is not necessarily bad. Doubt is entirely appropriate when you're in a doubtful situation. If you're walking along the street, you don't know whether you should go left or right. I have a doubt about that. Yes, you should have a doubt about it because you don't know. But when you're in meditation, if you have doubts that are undermining your meditation, this is when it becomes a hindrance. So you're meditating, oh, is this the right kind of meditation for me? Am I doing it right? Maybe I should be, I don't know, eating cheesecake instead, whatever. So you can, there are many different kind of doubts you can have in meditation that are going to undermine your practice. Okay, So this is a doubt. Now, all of these things are natural parts of your mind and natural forces in your mind. They will obstruct your meditation, but they will also be overcome through your meditation. And the Buddha said that all of these things can be overcome. Right? You overcome desire through letting go. Overcome anger through love. You overcome sloth torpor through energy. You overcome restlessness and remorse with peace, tranquility. You overcome doubt through inquiry, yeah, through wisdom. So these things can act as counter agents for these things. Now, when we talk about these five things, we usually translate them in English as the five hindrances, pancha nivarana. So hindrances is one word for them, but the word nivarana is an interesting word. In Pali, it always says that these are the things that weakened wisdom. Yeah, panya dublikarana, that they are weakeners of wisdom. It's kind of an interesting phrase, isn't it? Those things that weaken your wisdom. Yeah. Like you think about like how that works. I mean, just give you an obvious example. You've probably heard about things like the honeypot scams that on the internet, right? So somebody come along and chat and so on, and then like, oh, you meet some pretty girl or some hot guy or something like that, and they're interested in you and so on. Like, oh wow, they're really interested in me. And then that weakens your wisdom, and before you know it, oh sure, that seems reasonable. You want $20,000? Yeah. it seems that makes sense. Literally, that's how they work. Yeah, that's literally how they work. It's how advertising works, right? You create feelings and emotions in people's minds that weaken their wisdom, so that they don't make decisions on a rational or sensible basis. This is how these things work, to exaggerate and inflame those hindrances. Not to speak of politicians, right? Constantly doing this, especially with anger, right? They're deliberately inflaming anger to make people hate, so that they will vote against their own self-interest. Right? This is constantly what certain kinds of politicians are doing. Anyway, so weakening wisdom. So the word hindrance also has another meaning in Sanskrit. Originally, the idea of the hindrances comes from the serpent, the dragon, Vritra. So in Vedic mythology, 1,000 years before the Buddha, one of the most powerful myths was the myth of Vritra, the dragon, which is literally the constrictor, and the constrictor encircles the mountain and darkens everything. Yeah, so obstructing the light and crushing everything. And so the hero, who in the Vedic mythology is Indra, the sky god who wields the thunderbolt, and he comes along, smashes Vritra, lays waste to the body of the dragon across the countryside and all of these kinds of things, freeing the waters, opening up light and freeing the waters. So this can be understood in many ways. One dimension of that metaphor would be in terms of the cycles of the seasons in the Himalayas. Right? The darkness is the winter time when the snow and the ice is trapping and constricting everything, and then when the sun comes, it opens up and the waters flow freely. So that would be one dimension, but these kinds of mythologies never have just one single meaning. So you can see that idea is actually quite pertinent when you apply to your mind, because when you see these things in the mind, these things are, it's constricting your mind, it's endarkening your mind like a veil or a cloud, yeah, which is obstructing you from seeing things. So these are these five hindrances. So through practicing the meditation, we learn what these hindrances are, we learn what gives rise to them, we learn what sustains them, and we can learn how to overcome them, and we can learn what the mind is like free from these hindrances. Now, these hindrances are part of ordinary everyday meditation, and you will experience them and learn and familiarize yourself with them over time. If you like, you can focus your practice on one hindrance at a time. Let's say you might say, okay, I'm going to do sensual desire for the next month. All right? I don't mean that you should like do sensual desire. I mean that you should investigate sensual desire for that month, right? So for that 1 month, every time you meditate, then at the end of the meditation, you ask yourself, oh, how was my desire going? What was I wanting? Right? How strong was it? What was my mind pulling towards? How did that affect my mind? And so because you can focus on that one thing for a period of time, you get to know how that works, right? What are the kinds of things? And often it's kind of funny, right? It's kind of weird that the things that your desire is drawing you to are not the things that you might imagine. Like when I was a young monk at Wat Nanachat, so we were some fairly young community, mostly blokes, you'd think that we'd be thinking about sex the whole time. Right? No, I'm telling you, it was food. Like, absolutely. Like 95% of the time it's food, you know. So and that's something that you learn. You begin to learn, oh, what are your attachments and how are you being drawn towards these things? And you don't know that until you restrain yourself. Yeah. And then when you restrain yourself, you're like, oh, okay, yeah, that's what my mind is taking me towards. Okay, so...
I have a question.
Yeah.
So is this sensual desire is where the mind goes?
Yes.
Or is it sensual desire is a desire for such an experience out of the meditative practice?
So I'll just repeat for the online. The question is the sensual desire like where the mind goes, or is it in the meditation, or is it the desire for something after the meditation? Both, right? So it's very all-encompassing, any desire for anything, yeah? So you might be planning to do something afterwards, or you might be like, you know, wanting to do something then, or could be manifesting any different way.
I was thinking more of, because you spoke one of the previous weeks, that we have sometimes these desires of what to experience in the meditation. Like
The desire to experience in the meditation. Right. Okay.
So that's
okay. You're going to desire to have an orgasmic practice. That was the question. I wouldn't exactly put it that way personally, but... not really, no. So the desire to experience things in meditation is slightly different, actually, because the desire to have good meditation is a wholesome desire, and it leads to you continuing your meditation, right? So this actually comes under another heading, which is not exactly mentioned within the five hindrances, but is a more kind of subtle form of desire. So the desire for spiritual things, right, whether it's meditation or something like that, is not included in this, because the desire for the spiritual thing propels you on the path and it will ultimately reveal itself. So for some time, you maybe have that, and it can still disturb your mind and still be an attachment. It's true. Mm-hmm. But over time, you will overcome that attachment. It doesn't self-perpetuate like the desire for sensual things. The reason for that is because the spiritual realizations that you have are genuinely satisfying. Yeah, that's the difference. So you don't look 100% convinced.
But you can still intend to like have that.
You still can, yeah.
Which isn't that.
It is still an attachment, but it's a more subtle form of attachment. Yeah.
Where the mind goes in those kind of vibes.
That's right, yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, it's not to say that that's not a thing, but it's not an urgent problem for most of the time for meditators when they're developing meditation. Yeah, it's actually okay to have some attachment to your practice. And so I talked to Ajahn Brahm about this years ago. He said, well, it's better than being attached to something really stupid. Fair enough. Okay, so that's the five hindrances, the endarkeners, the veils that are trapping us and keeping our mind from being free. And then we have these seven awakening factors, seven bojangas. So seven bojangas, question, Alex, how many are there? Great, right? So I'm very proud of you guys. It's like it's such a good community here. People really know what they're talking about. So and what are they? Mindfulness. Investigation of dhammas, right?
Virya.
Virya, the energy. Rapture.
Joy.
That's a rapture, that's a joy. Tranquility, samadhi, equanimity. Wow, that's awesome, you know. That's great. So let's briefly run through these. So sati is mindfulness. This is what we've been talking about this whole time. Mindfulness, again, to repeat, is essentially the maintaining of the continuity in awareness. So it's remembering what it is that you're doing while you're doing it. Okay, is my quality of mindfulness. Then investigation, Dhamma Vichaya, is the same as what I've been talking about now with the contemplation of Dhamma's contemplation of principles, the reflection about what we're doing. Normally, actually, that quality comes at the end, but in this particular set of Dhammas, it comes near the beginning for reasons that could be discussed, but that's normally how that happens. Okay, so then when you're investigating, practicing mindfulness, then energy arises, okay? So this is the next quality. Energy is one of the most prominent qualities in Buddhist meditation. In fact, you find energy mentioned more often than anything else. And the word for energy, or one of the words for energy, is the word padhana. And padhana is, in fact, the name, one of the standard names in Sanskrit or Pali for a meditation hall is a padhana sala, right? Literally like a striving hall, right? So it's very kind of closely connected with the idea of meditating. So we have to do our meditation. And I know that in this course, I've been talking about like not pushing too much, not concentrating too hard, and so on. And I just want you to understand that there's a history to that and a culture to that. Okay. If you listen to the teachers of the forest tradition where I came from, they often say, put a lot of effort in, strive, try really hard. Okay, and when you hear that, you go, okay, I'm going to take that, I'm going to do that. But then when you go and live there, okay, these are the most relaxed people you've ever seen in your life. Like I remember one time I came back after the meal time, it's like 10 o'clock, there's this group of monks just sitting there, and I come back to do chores at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and they're still just sitting there. And they're like just literally doing nothing. How do you just do nothing all day, like literally nothing? And this is the thing that we saw, as the Western monks saw with the local Thai monks, that they have the capacity to do nothing. It's amazing. Like, we can't do nothing. Like, you have to, like, do meditation or do study or do some chores or do something, You can't just not do. What would that even be like? It's bizarre. Just to be, it's crazy. I don't think this is a cultural thing in the sense of like Eastern versus Western culture or something like that. I think it's actually a rural versus urban thing. I think in country, you know that's rice growing country, right? You work really hard, right, to sow the rice, prepare it, bring the water in, all of that stuff. And then when the rice is all planted, you don't do anything. You just wait for a few months. And they have like all night parties and all of this kind of stuff. So there's actually, it's like an understanding of like a way of being that there's a time to work and a time to relax. And I think that we've kind of lost that. We've lost that because of electric lights, which have banished the nighttime. We've lost that because capitalism tells us we have to justify our existence by productivity. And I remember there was an interview with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez a few years ago. She was asked about whether she was worried about whether robots were going to take away people's jobs. And she said she's more worried that people have been trained to think that their worth is dependent on their economic productivity. So energy has that ebb and that flow. It doesn't just mean pushing, but it has a time for effort, a time for relaxing and learning that. So if you are going to one side of being overly relaxed and chill, then you need to be told to do more effort. If, like most people here, probably conditioned in an urban environment, work hard, get achieve, then we need to say, okay, let's just relax, okay. So these things are culturally conditioned. Hasa, you had a question? Padhana, you mean is that the last word? Apamadena sampadeta. No, it's a different word. Yeah. Different word, yeah. Yeah. Similar meaning, but different word. There's quite a few words for energy in Pali. All right, so energy, rapture. We talked about this under the contemplation of feelings, right? When your mind is flowing well and the meditation is going well, you feel joy. Then the rapture goes to tranquility, right? It's like an evenness and a settledness, yeah? And then the tranquility is associated with bliss, with pleasure, and it leads to samadhi. I talked a little bit about samadhi last week under the contemplation of the mind. So samadhi is a deep state of immersion. And it's important, it's a difficult word to translate, okay? As a translator, okay, I'll tell you a story. As a translator, when I started translating the Pali text, 1.5 million words, and my initial thing was I'm not going to leave anything in Pali, okay? I'm going to translate everything because basically you end up with a kind of a quasi-hybrid language when you start leaving words in Pali. So I thought, okay, no, don't do it. I'm going to put everything in English. Everything can be translated, and samadhi was one of the hardest words to translate. Struggled with it many, many times, back and forth. And when I came back to Australia, I went to a conference, and at the conference I was sitting in the evening at a table with Susan Moylan Coombs, who some of you may know. She actually lives not far from here, and she was she stood against Tony Abbott when he was still running for. Yeah, Warringah Council, yeah. Anyway, so blah, 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 we're sitting there chatting and so on. And she, by the way, she's Aboriginal elder. She told me of my totem. She said, your totem is a kangaroo.
Oh.
Because they only go forward and they can't go back. I said, oh, my God, I met you for 10 minutes. You know me already. Okay, so... And she said, oh, you know, we were talking because I said, oh, she said, what have you been doing? And I'd just been translating. She said, oh, you know, she said, so some words we have in Aboriginal languages that you just don't have in English. And I'm like, okay, try me. Okay. I felt like this was a professional challenge, right? Okay. I'm like, try me. She's like, okay, so we have this word, kabarananga, which means a still, peaceful, and clear state of mind. I'm like, oh, yeah, okay, you're right. But there is a word in Pali for that, which is samadhi. So difficult word to translate, but samadhi has two, one of the reasons it's tricky is because samadhi is very similar in Pali to the word jhana, okay? And they have two meanings. One is, both have two meanings. One is to come together, to coalesce, and the other is to illuminate and to be bright. So this is the mind that has coalesced and come together and is illuminated from within. And under the contemplation of mind, we talked about this a little bit, and we talked about how you can actually begin to see that illumination as it happens in the mind. So this is samadhi, and the final factor is upekkha, or equanimity. Now, equanimity in Buddhism is usually the last of any particular set. It's the last thing. This is very important to remember, okay? Don't be too equanimous too quickly, okay? Equanimity is an outcome of all of those other things, the joy and all of these things, right? There's a difference between equanimity and indifference, okay? So in a court case, you want the judge to be equanimous but not indifferent, okay? If the judge is indifferent, that means they couldn't care and they're not paying attention. You don't want that, but you want them to be equanimous, as in they're not prejudging the case. But the word upekkha, we translate it as equanimity, but it literally means watching closely. Upa is close, ikkha means to watch, literally watching closely. Yeah, and so it means when everything has been developed and everything is good, then we watch closely. Yeah, it doesn't just mean we just watch while all the mess is happening and pretend we're being equanimous. When everything is in balance and everything is good, then we have that equanimity. So these are the seven awakening factors, and this is one of the most important presentations of the Dhamma. In fact, the four groups, the four satipatthanas, four kinds of mindfulness meditation, body, feeling, mind, and dhammas, and the five hindrances, sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse and doubt, and the seven awakening factors, mindfulness, investigation of dhammas, energy, rapture, tranquility, samadhi and equanimity. These three sets are often presented together. They sort of go together as a kind of a group. So the Buddha said that whoever gets enlightened does so by developing the four kinds of mindfulness meditation, abandoning the five hindrances and developing the seven awakening factors, and finally realizing the four noble truths. And the four noble truths are the final part of this contemplation of dhammas. How many are there? Four noble truths, and suffering, the origin of suffering, the ending of suffering, and the path. Okay, so the path is what we've been talking about this whole time. Suffering is what's going on in your life now, pretty much. And the ending of suffering is, the cause of suffering is a craving and attachment, and the ending of suffering is when you can let go of that craving and attachment. This is the four, in brief, is the four noble truths. And the understanding of those four noble truths emerges from the development of all of these factors, right? Now we can understand it again, remember what I said before about the development of the different stages of wisdom, of the wisdom through learning, which is what we're doing here, the wisdom through meditation and development and inquiry, which we do when we sit to meditate, and then finally the intuitive wisdom of realization. And when you have that deep level intuitive wisdom of realization, then you see the Four Noble Truths and you let go permanently of those things inside you that you've been holding on to that have been causing suffering for yourself and for others. And those things are gone. Once they're gone, they don't come back. Okay, so this is the promise that the Buddha gave. There's the promise of enlightenment. So the realization of the Four Noble Truths initially happens with the first stage of enlightenment that we call stream entry. So, and then that abandons certain kinds of defilements and sets you on a trajectory towards complete freedom. So this is, in brief, the contemplation of dhammas in the Satipatthana. And so I've tried throughout these talks to convey this sense of these four Satipatthanas as being an organic whole which leads us from those very simple, the very simple fact of sitting down to meditate and watching the breath. And there needs to be an integrated and holistic understanding of how that then proceeds and evolves through to all the stages of meditation and to liberation as well. They all have that same essence. You're just doing the same thing. It's the same thing. And as you go at a deeper and deeper level, and you begin to realize the fruits of it, but you will realize the that these things work through your own practice. Okay, it's not like you have to do a certain amount before you'll even know that there's anything that works. You can sit down and meditate for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, and see that your mind has become more peaceful. That's the results of that practice. And the experience of awakening is simply continuing that at deeper and deeper levels. Okay, so that's all for this evening. And I'd like to open up for some questions for those in here in Sydney or those in the online world. Bhante Bhairatna, how's it going? Venerable? Venerables of Dhammasara and Santi. Christelle in Sweden. Dhera Yupa down in Melbourne or outside of Melbourne. Janet. Marianne. Kristen, Mike, and all of our other friends around the place. Megan. Okay.
When you were talking about the three kinds of wisdom, the third kind that you talked about, which was the intuitive wisdom, is it something that you felt in the body, or is it more of kind of like in the mind level that you know it's intuitive wisdom?
Okay, so the intuitive wisdom, is that something that you feel in your body, or is that more of a mind level? Kind of both, actually. Yeah, like really kind of deep level wisdom comes from a place of integration where the distinctions between those things have kind of been dissolved. Yeah, so it's not from a mind level in the sense of like, you know, rationalizing about things, but there is something you feel the results of it in your body for sure.
So it's like a sense of conviction.
That's part of it. Yes. Yeah. There's a rightness to it. Like you know, there's a rightness to it. Often when you meditate, right? So meditation is extremely good for decision making. Because a lot of the times we've already made the decision, but we don't quite realize it. And then while you're meditating, then it'll come to you, oh, yeah, this is what I'm doing, but I didn't say it. And when that, like, you notice, again, when that happens, at the end of the meditation, reflect back on that experience. What was it like to feel that confidence, right, to know that, oh, this is the truth? Yeah, there's a quality that has. It's hard to pin down. But remember, stream entry, the realization of the Four Noble Truths, what's the characteristic? Confidence. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. It's an intuitive realization, but just at a deeper level, that's all. Yeah, and you feel that confidence when all of those different parts come together.
Yeah. I would say it's like it's happened to me once in my life to have that experience, and it was like just this pure awareness. Like it's not a thought, it's not a feeling, it's just like you just know.
You just know. Yeah.
Awareness is like the most appropriate.
Yeah. You just know, right? And you know that you know.
No.
But now you know.
Thought process.
Yeah, sure.
It's not an effortful thinking pattern of a decision making. It's just there.
Yeah.
I wonder if maybe that's why there's some people that, what do you call them? Claircognizant and clairsentient. Mm-hmm. The two types of clairvoyance.
Claircognizant and clairsentient. I have not heard those words before.
Claircognizant is like just now.
Okay.
Without any logical explanation. But clairsentient is you feel, get the person's emotion. Sometimes they can.
Okay. Right. And I think these things are all developed through meditation. I come to the second, but then you had a question.
So, how did you translate to someone?
Oh, immersion.
Why in stillness?
So Ajahn Brahm translates samadhi as stillness. I found that it was difficult to make it work as a translation, and if you're actually working with Pali texts, so you'd have things like the monk was practicing stillness in the forest, right? Okay, they were just standing still. So really, kind of, it was one of those. Well, I found that it wasn't a term that was actually. Like I said, I went through pretty much every possible thing. Yeah.
Do you still feel that it should be translated?
Yes. Should samadhi still be translated? Look, do you want me? I can ramble on about this for ages. Okay. So, should you want me to ramble on about it
yes,
a bit?
Please.
Okay. Sure. No. Okay. Fine. Okay. So, word samadhi. One of the reasons why the word samadhi is difficult to translate, firstly, because we don't really have a word for it in English. That's number one. But secondly, because it's also used in different ways in modern Buddhist culture or in modern culture. So you have to have a way, if you just leave it as samadhi, then it is going to be misinterpreted in different ways by different people. So those four, there's four real meanings for it. Number one is a Hindu meaning. So in India, samadhi means the state of union of the soul with the cosmos, which happens at the time of the death of the saint. Okay, so if you're in India and you hear samadhi, that's what it means. So that's obviously not what it means in Buddhism. It also means in the Vipassana traditions, it means like a momentary awareness of changing phenomena from moment to moment, which is, again, not what it means in the suttas. So in Thailand, samadhi is used as a word just for meditation. So if I say, I'm going to go and sit meditation, you say, I'm going to go and sit samadhi, right? Right, but that doesn't mean that in the suttas, right? It's never used as just a word for meditation. It's used for the state of consciousness that emerges from deep meditation. Right? So that's four. And then finally, it's used, both samadhi and jhana are used, especially in modern American Buddhism, are often used for a very kind of weak state of concentration, which is sometimes, Ajahn Brahm calls it banana jhana. And for sort of say, well, you feel a bit still, and you feel kind of a bit sort of, I don't know, a bit happy or something, and then that's a jhana, and you're in a state of samadhi or something like that. So I don't really know. So this has been really popularized by a lot of teachers in America, especially, and I think frankly, I think it's because in America people don't like to think that they can't have the things that they want. So you have to be able to have it. So anyway. I had a chat. Oh, I won't go on to it. So I wanted a translation that would exclude these four possibilities. So concentration doesn't really work. Stillness doesn't really work. Another one I tried was coalescence, which I think is pretty good actually, but doesn't quite work. So immersion is similar in meaning to absorption. And we use it psychologically for similar kind of senses. Right, so I'm sitting at home, I'm loving my book, I'm sitting there reading, I don't even hear the front door open, right? Oh, I was so immersed in my book that I didn't even hear that, yeah? So that kind of sense that you're so deeply into it that even your external senses will be shut down. So
like
that's
what
it meant.
State?
Sorry?
Like flow state?
Kind of like a flow state, but a flow state is also moving. Samadhi is still.
So jhana is
jhana's absorption. So absorption and immersion have a similar kind of sense. Yeah, illumination would be another possibility. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but then if you choose it, you can't change it based on context. I suppose if you're translating samadhi, then you consistently translate the same way.
Generally speaking, yeah, so again, I'm not sure how much detail we go into. Yes, in translations we translate according to context, right? So there's a number of different problems. One problem is that there's context in the Buddha's time and there's a context today. So that's also a context. So the people who heard the word samadhi in the Buddha's day had a different sense than the people who hear the word samadhi today, right? So that's also a problem. But also even within those texts, there are different contexts where it appears, right? So then also normally you might want to translate words differently in different contexts, right? But the suttas are very unusual literature. The Buddhist texts are very unusual literature in that they tend to use a lot of technical terms which have very specific meanings and are used very consistently. So it's not actually like translating a novel or translating something like that where you're much more fluid in translating different words according to context. The suttas tends to be much more technical in that way. So we generally try as translators to use the same rendering when it's used in the same meaning. Yeah. So it's not always easy to do.
Does any version require a description?
A description?
Yeah, like the people are speaking. What? I find it like some of the other words are like more descriptive, whereas immersion is like necessitates.
Yeah. If immersion requires some description, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Like if you when you're describing samadhi, you're describing something which is a profound and subtle state, which is hard to understand. And if you're reading a translation and you immediately think, oh, I know what that is, like say concentration, then that itself is kind of a problem. So it's okay if it's a difficult thing, it's okay to read it. It's an immersion. What's that? And then maybe then I read some notes or read about it and then learn more about it. So again, these are just some, it's not right or wrong, but there's just like some of the considerations that lie behind these choices. So, but I tell you what, nobody struggles with these things more than a translator. Yes, John. Yes. Yes. Sama samadhi is the four jhanas, yes.
So it's absolution.
That's correct, yes. So samadhi and jhana are almost always used as synonyms in the suttas.
And then
there's
two jhanas and hard jhana.
That's right, there's some people who say that, yes. See above re banana jhanas, yes. The funny thing, okay, don't get me even started on this. So Lee Brazenton has this thing about Sutta Jhanas versus the Abhidhamma Jhanas and things like that. But funnily enough, none of the people that I know that actually know the suttas well think that this kind of analysis has any credibility whatsoever. Honestly, it's so amateurish, it's ridiculous. I don't even know how to begin, but I can tell you from somebody who's been studying the suttas for 30 years and has translated all of them and has been practicing meditation that whole time, that this is not a valid kind of distinction, and it's kind of annoying, to be honest. So the meaning of jhanas and samadhi in the suttas is very profound, and we can see from any number of contexts that it was seen as being a profound, transformative experience, which was akin to becoming one with God or akin to being on the boundaries of ultimate emptiness and infinite consciousness. I mean, this is not just something that you do while doing a bit of meditation when sitting at the bus stop, you know. This is why the sages of old left their homes and went into the Himalayas and practiced for 20 years in a cave, you know. So, anyway, I didn't really want to sort of get onto that stuff kind of too much, but now you know. How's everyone going online? Okay, so, oh, samadhi means burial in Malay, according to Onwe Chung. Is that right? I don't know, is that the same word? Samadhi? 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 Is it the same word?
Oh, yeah. Samadhi.
Samadhi? Could be.
Yeah. Going off in the cave to do that.
Maybe, could be, could be, I'm not sure. Right, so Dhiriyupa comments, entire samadhi can also mean have focused attention, have samadhi while listening to the teacher, for example. Yeah. Kevin says, third step, body means whole body. Okay, look, Kevin's asked a question about anapanasati. Kevin, I won't get into that right now. It's a good question, but maybe at a future talk, if that's okay. But look, generally, if I might just say that I don't really think that the distinction between the whole body and the whole body of breath is particularly a meaningful distinction, because the breath, in fact, pervades your whole body. So I don't think that I don't think it's as important a distinction as people make it to be. TH says, we can't seem to avoid crazy, unethical, selfish, nasty people. How do we maintain our sanity in samsara? TH, mate, I know exactly what you mean, okay? I know exactly what you mean. I have no idea. We can be peaceful among those who are violent. We can be wise among the foolish. Yeah. Samadhi cognates with samadhi, yeah. Okay, so look, thanks everyone. We should wrap up about there. This was the final in this series of four talks on the introduction to Buddhist meditation. However, these sessions will continue and we'll be doing a variety of other talks. I'm going to do a talk next week, both here and in Tuesdays at Parramatta, will be on...
What's the rock title? You're
going to
give it a rock title?
No, that will be later. No, the next one is going to be on the Year of the Fire Horse. We're going to be on the Year of the Fire Horse, and I am going to reveal something that I've never talked about in public before.
Oh, that's
okay. 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 So make sure you come for next week. Okay. This is called marketing, okay? So we will be back here same time next week in Crow's Nest, for those folks online, and in Parramatta on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. at 5 Parramatta Square at 6 p.m. So please come along. And that one is not online. That is only in person. So if you're around Parramatta or if you know anyone in Parramatta, please come along. And also just remember just to share, let people know, encourage people to come along. And it's nice to have a connection and to do some practice together.
And I'm testing. We'll be doing two more sessions on Wednesday night.
I will be doing two more sessions on Wednesday. I'll also be doing some talks with the Metta Center. Check the Metta Center website for those details. It is funny. It is funny. Now that you mentioned the word five, because I do recall that you had asked me to give a talk for the Metta Center, and now we have five talks.
Yes.
Yeah. It's curious little detail there. Anyway, I'm very happy to help. Very happy to help out with the friends at the Metta Center, who are doing an awesome job. I just want to say, I'm so thrilled to see what the Metta Center has been doing in Sydney. So, five aggregates to five, bring your five hindrances and five aggregates to the five, with the seven awakening factors at six. Okay, fine. Thanks, everybody. Be happy, take care, sir.